On one side is a man who inherited a fortune from his father and kept it going by cheating people, by skipping out on debts.
To the Bernie or bust people, you're being ridiculous.
Patriotism is love of country, but you can't love your country without loving your countrymen and your countrywomen.
Many of you have families. Ignore them. An 8-year-old kid can teach a 4-year-old kid to use a microwave oven. It's just scientific fact. Get on those phones, knock on those doors.
I wake up every morning in a house that was built by slaves. And I watch my daughters, two beautiful, intelligent black young women, playing with their dogs on the White House lawn.
Based on her ideas and her leadership, Hillary Clinton must become the next president of the United States.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. From the furnace of Philly to the chilly of a Moscow summer day, who is running this show? This hour, the clash of scripts on the podium at the Democratic National Convention. One from Hillary Clinton, one from angry Bernie Sanders delegates, and perhaps one more taken from a very old playbook in Russia. Vladimir Putin's elections are apparently too boring. Perhaps he's looking to meddle in the USA. This hour, the Philly furnace burns with a Russian flame. We'll try to get to the bottom of those allegations of Russian meddling, and we'll hear some voices from Philly 2016. Todd Zwillick, how's it felt in that furnace the past 24 hours?
Yeah, John, another stifling hot day outside of the convention in Philly. And as soon as Vance, our Philly cab driver, dropped us off, you knew there was going to be heat inside the room, too. Bernie Sanders supporters who booed and yelled. Yeah, they're a minority on the floor, but they're also a loud one. Jamie Friend is from Hollywood, California.
Nobody in this room will acknowledge that the DNC frauded our country, gave us misinformation, deliberately disenfranchised voters, suppressed the turnout, and we don't get a mention of it. Everybody's in denial in this room. It blows my mind.
So, John, it was a night programmed to maximize the chances of unity and to take away some of those objections, substantive, a lot of them, maybe even emotional, some of them, of Bernie Sanders supporters. They've been upset, of course, about the primary process, about Hillary Clinton's center-left politics, and most recently, those DNC emails. But, John, this evening at the convention, the official vote to enter Hillary Clinton's name in nomination as president, and as we saw at the RNC last week in Cleveland, what is usually kind of a pro forma gavel-to-gavel exercise has become controversial and an opportunity for the minority at this convention. Bernie supporters will be pushing hard for a roll call vote and a show of force, and in his speech to the delegates last night in prime time, Bernie Sanders himself backed that idea.
I look forward to your votes during the roll call tomorrow night.
So it seems like a minimum thing to grant to the supporters. Let them have their moment.
Let them have their moment, but that has its risks because those roll call votes can get contentious when individual states vote loudly for somebody who is not the nominee. But that's Sanders' point, too. Let them have their moment. And the DNC may choose to do that in their effort to change the mood in that room and have some inclusiveness. John, there was some savvy programming on the part of convention organizers last night. This is a divided room. And before the main speakers last night, out came pro-Hillary senator and comedian Al Franken, along with pro-Bernie comedian Sarah Silverman, together to basically get laughs, talk about unity, and warm up the room.
This past year, I've been hashtag I'm with her.
And I'm Sarah Silverman, and this past year, I've been feeling the burn. Relax, I put some cream on it.
Didn't you love Franken's parenting advice? It's okay to leave your parents at home. The 7-year-old can teach the 4-year-old how to use the microwave so you can go out and campaign for Hillary.
Many of you have families. Ignore them. That was Al Franken's advice, and it's true that he got a lot of big laughs in the room. But then, John, the only important question was the comedy and the togetherness with the comics on the stage, did it work? prime time came, Michelle Obama, Elizabeth Warren, and then critically, Bernie Sanders himself, all pushing those different versions of stronger together, the unity required to beat the Republicans and their nominee, Donald Trump. And then afterward, the question is, was it enough to convince Bernie Sanders' followers to get on board? Sandra Lourdes is a superdelegate with Democrats Abroad.
I'm very concerned because she's not well-liked. And the people who are mad at her have justifiable reasons to be mad at her. And I don't see her doing anything to help. I mean, Debbie Wasserman Schultz was given another position right away. And there was no reprimand. There was no accountability. There was no apologizing to us. We're supposed to chin up, take it, and get in line. And some people aren't going to do that, especially these young people, these new-to-the-party people. They have no reason. They have no loyalty yet.
John, one thing that strikes you in that convention is the similarity between some of the hardcore Bernie Sanders delegates here and many Ted Cruz supporters last week. Now, neither of those two groups would want to hear that, but it's true. They feel disenfranchised by their party, left out, and some say that no matter what, they're not going to work for their party's nominee. I talked to Miguel Angel Zuniga at the end of the night. He's a Bernie delegate. He works at Costco in La Mita, California.
I will not stand with election fraud. I have morals, and I vote with my morals. I'm not scared of Trump as much as I'm not scared of Hillary. We will campaign against this party for the rest of my life, and this is coming from a lifetime Democrat. I'm sorry, but Bernie's the only answer, and we will not win Trump with Hillary, because we're going to vote against Hillary, too.
I guess the main difference, though, is that the Bernie supporters aren't going to do that distasteful, I'm not going to support you, demonstration that was so awkward at the Republican convention. They're trying to get this over in one day.
The Democrats are trying to get this over in one day, and today will tell if they're successful, John. There's a running theme under what the Clinton and Sanders campaigns are trying to do here, convince Democrats and Bernie supporters that they're stronger together in November if they're united. A few people in the crowd seem to take it to heart. Sandra Lourdes, who we heard from earlier, was sitting on the convention floor with a new friend, actually, last night. Her name was Gilda Reed, and she was a Bernie delegate from Louisiana.
Well, we're doing fine. We're doing fine. She really agrees with some of the same things I do. She just is for a different person.
We'll know a lot more tonight, John. That nomination vote is today. Sanders supporters want that roll call vote. Many are talking about various protest actions in addition to that. They're going to be hearing more unity messages from the stage, of course, from popular Democrats in prime time tonight, Vice President Joe Biden and former president and possible future first gentleman, Bill Clinton.
So that's how you would refer to him, first gentleman. Learn something new every day. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Whatever you think of the politics of Barack Obama, think about it. What woman in America wasn't interested in seeing and hearing Michelle Obama last night at the Democratic National Convention? Think about her experience for the last 8 years. A first lady, having given up a lucrative career in healthcare, having two girls to raise through their most difficult years.
I will never forget that winter morning as I watched our girls, just 7 and 10 years old, pile into those black SUVs with all those big men with guns. And I saw their little faces pressed up against the window. And the only thing I could think was, what have we done?
Who can't relate to that? Michelle Obama's role as a mentor came naturally, and it was one she took on everywhere she went. In 2009, she spoke at the Elizabeth Garrett Anderson School, an all-girls school at the underserved community of Islington in North London, England.
All of you are jewels. You are precious, and you touch my heart. And it is important for the world to know that there are wonderful girls like you all over the world.
She's all in there. Mrs. Obama continued to stay in touch with those girls who were inspired by her words and found success in their later studies. Sentiments found in this year's commencement address at City College of New York.
When I wake up in a house that was built by slaves, and I watch my daughters, two beautiful black young women, head off to school, waving goodbye to their father, the President of the United States, the son of a man from Kenya who came here to America for the same reasons as many of you.
Michelle borrowed that line from one of her earlier speeches in her speech last night, but nobody called it plagiarism. Nope. Kate Anderson Brower joins us, author of First Women, The Grace and Power of America's Modern First Ladies. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This Michelle Obama narrative of, I can't get this image of waking up in a house built by slaves and watching their daughters go off to school. I mean, she has a perspective like no other that's even deeper, it seems to me, than Barack Obama's perspective in some level.
It reminded me a little bit about Rosalynn Carter when she said something similar. She remembered watching their daughter Amy put on a bulletproof vest when they were on a tour in Italy after some violence had erupted there. And this was, of course, in the 70s. And she talked about watching her daughter put on this bulletproof vest. And she had the exact same sentiment of, you know, what have we done? And I think that Michelle Obama is able to verbalize that in, a, like you said, a very relatable way. I was really surprised that she was emotional last night. I mean, her relationship with Hillary has been kind of fraught. Of course, the 2008 campaign was very hard fought, but I really believe that she's moved past that. And clearly last night, I mean, she was the only one who was able to get the chorus of Sanders people to sort of not say anything. And it was very, it was, you could hear a pin drop. And I thought that was incredible.
Do you think that's partly because she is so relieved that this is sort of her swan song and now we have her legacy to look at?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, when I was working on my book, friends of the Obamas would tell me how miserable she was in the White House. Not that she recognizes the incredible opportunity she has there as the first African-American first lady, but they said that she also feels particularly scrutinized because of that at the same time.
And it's just not her thing. I mean, that's what people describe. It's not like she's got some problem with the White House. It's just totally not her thing.
Right. And I mean, people forget that she was the breadwinner in that family for a long time when Barack Obama was in the state legislature. So she wants to work. And one of her friends said, you know, it's really difficult. It was hard for her to give up her career and move to Washington, give up her friends. I mean, convincing her mother to come with her to the White House was a big ask. And her mom was very reluctant. But that's really helped her daughters and given them a sense of normalcy. But right last night, I mean, it was incredible to see her really take Donald Trump to task without ever mentioning his name. And that was kind of brilliant.
And so classy, not to mention anything with the Melania. I mean, a lot of us talked about that in the newsrooms, but nah, not a peep.
No, I was wondering if she would make some quip, you know, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery or something like that. But, you know, I thought she probably wouldn't because also I do think that this is very personal for her with when it comes to Donald Trump, particularly because of, and she mentioned it last night, his questioning her husband's citizenship. I think that for her, this is the most personal campaign. It's certainly different from 2012, where Mitt Romney was an entirely different candidate. And this has really sparked something in her that was incredible to watch.
The Joining Forces initiative out of the First Lady's office has really been a vital program for veterans and their families. But it seems also that she identifies with what those families are going through in that there is a male member of the family or female member of the family going through a particular stress. And, you know, Joining Forces is all about rallying the troops within your family in a difficult situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, because she describes her life as a single mother at some points, you know, I mean, that she understands what it's like to parent alone because her husband was gone so often and to try to make things work. And she often says, you know, it takes a village, going back to what Hillary Clinton famously said. But I think she relates to the women and the men who stay behind when their spouses are far away and in danger, you know. And I also think it was very powerful to watch her and Jill Biden with the Military Family Initiative really talk about how a lot of Americans don't know anyone in the military now. And she said herself, she didn't know anyone serving. And it's this whole segment of the population that I think she's done a lot to emphasize and to really bring put a spotlight on.
Well, that's a division in America we almost never talk about, but it's really, really important. Thinking about her Let's Move campaign, her fitness campaign, comes directly out of reports we used to hear about how she tried to strictly regulate the diet of her two daughters. And boom, it's been very successful as well.
Yeah, you know, I covered her for Bloomberg News when I was a White House reporter, and I talked to some, you know, executives at big food companies and then some lobbyists with the food industry. This was a very controversial campaign. I mean, most first ladies, they take up some apolitical campaign. And while on paper, most people would think that healthy eating is fairly apolitical, it really wasn't. I mean, she's been criticized as being the food police, but also she was fighting against these giant corporations. You know, fast food companies that have responded by offering now apple slices with Happy Meals and things like that. I mean, you can actually see some concrete evidence of stepping in the right direction. But her promise of ending childhood obesity in a generation is one that is unlikely to be met. But it's, again, it's, you know, first ladies have this incredible platform. And one first lady told me that, you know, no one will ever not take a call from a first lady. It is just, you have this incredible platform, and I think she's used it in a very innovative way.
Well, Kate Anderson Brower, author of First Women, The Grace and Power of America's Modern First Ladies, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The road to Philly has been long for Hillary Clinton, but it is a path that a number of successful women politicians have also trod in their own lives and careers. Congresswoman Anna Eshoo of California's 18th Congressional District, nestled by the Pacific, west of San Jose, has risen fast as an activist and lawmaker. She champions the cause of innovation on the Hill, along with energy and women's equity issues. She told her story to Todd Zwillick in Philly.
The first time I ran was in 1988, and I lost in 88. And I remember when the pollster broke down some of the polling, and I said, I'm so excited. I don't want to hear about the rest of this stuff. Tell me what women think. And he said, you better fasten your seatbelt. And I said, what are you talking about? Because I had done so much to advance women legislatively. And the polling from women was, she should stay home and take care of her children. So there was a resentment on the part of women.
That's shocking.
At that time. That was 1988. And then I ran again in 1992. It was called The Year of the Woman. Imagine, it just was going to be one year for women, right? And won.
What did that tell you at the time in 88 when your pollster said...
Oh, I was crestfallen. I couldn't shake it. I couldn't shake it. I was so stunned. I was so stunned and so deeply unsettled about it. How could it be that that would be their take on me?
Can you recall a time for me, maybe earlier in your career, maybe in Congress, when it was time to make a deal or negotiate a bill? I've heard this from other women. Make a deal, negotiate a bill, you're an elected member of Congress, you have a pen, and it was made clear to you somehow that people who'd been in Congress longer maybe didn't consider you part of the club, and, you know, they don't. I've been told by others there was a time where
I've never really allowed anyone to treat me that way. Have many tried over the years? Absolutely. Now I've gotten to the point where I can just smile and keep going. I remember when I first got there, when you came off the floor of the House, you actually are on the second floor of the Capitol. And at that time, they had the rotating doors, which I think are dangerous. And someone pushed the door very hard, and right behind me pushed me, and I almost fell, which is dangerous because there are steps there. And I said to one of the members, oh my God, I said, I almost fell, you know, and it's dangerous. And he said, what more do you want? You got here. I've never forgotten that. What more do you want? You got here.
Eshoo has been in Congress since 1993 and is rapidly becoming a senior member. In California's 13th Congressional District, across the Bay Bridge, it's a diverse community filled with contrast. There's Oakland and Emeryville, Piedmont, and Congresswoman Barbara Lee. She's famous for being the only vote against authorization to use force against any enemies connected with the attacks of 9/11. She called it a blank check for war. Was she wrong? She loves being outspoken, unafraid, and a woman still happy to go up against intolerance wherever she finds it.
You know, and this still happens now in meetings, for example. You have an idea that really is embraced, and then oftentimes men embrace that idea as theirs. And here you said it first, this is the plan, or this is the issue, or this is the position. And, you know, oftentimes they'll embrace it and say the same thing you said as if it were their own and not say, well, as... And, you know, that's just one little, you know, one little, I think, example. But when you come from where I come from as an African-American woman, you know, oftentimes, you know, I was seen as someone who was still working for someone, for example, and not my own person as a member of Congress. So I had to make sure, you know, they understood that I was elected just like they were.
We're at this moment now, of course, this is going to be the first woman nominee in history, and that's a huge first. Strangely, though, it seems to me somehow that Hillary Clinton, that the attention to the first that this represents is less, for instance, than when President Obama was the nominee, and there was a great deal of attention, and rightfully so, out of the fact that he was the first African-American nominee and then the first African-American president. Some attention is paid to Hillary Clinton in this regard, but it seems to me that this moment of the first nominee, that she's, I don't know why, but she seems to have so far lost out on the gravitas of that moment at all. And I don't think I'm alone in that. I think other people have you perceived that, and do you have a...
Yes, but you know, that might be a good thing. That might mean that women have entered this political system in a way that is not unusual anymore. And that, I think, is a testament to her and her experience. I mean, she's got a long record in terms of her political experience. She's got a history. And perhaps, and I'm not saying this is the case, but perhaps, you know, there's a new standard being set now. I mean, what I want to make sure of is, and I think young women really understand this, that there were many battles fought by women before today that we could risk losing if, in fact, we don't elect Hillary Clinton. You know, issues around women's health and reproductive health care. Well, it wasn't always so that we had Roe versus Wade, for example. And so I think what's more important is to recognize we need Hillary Clinton in the White House to protect the gains that women have made. But I think in many ways it's really, I think, a plus for Hillary Clinton in the sense that her history and her experience bring her to this point. And I'm so delighted she's a woman.
You're saying that maybe people have become sort of inured to the idea of her candidacy, not only because she's been on the scene for so long, but maybe we've gotten to the point where there was an assumption that there would be a woman president before long, and people just go, oh, yeah, right.
I think you're right. I think that's what Shirley Chisholm wanted to do. That's what Reverend Jesse Jackson wanted to do. They paved the way so that it's not a shock. You know, I'm humbled by that, and I have to honor the legacy of all of those who paved the way for this to happen. I think that's really how I feel. So many people did so much to get us here. And so that, to me, is what we should be celebrating in addition to our nominee, but just the fact that, you know, blood, sweat, and tears, you know, paved this way.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
California Representatives Barbara Lee and Anna Eshoo speaking to Todd Zwillick at the DNC in Philadelphia. Perhaps the most entertained audience for the Democratic National Convention show in Philly is in the Kremlin right now, where they might be downing blinis and vodka while chuckling over this.
All we know right now is what experts are telling us.
That's Hillary Clinton's campaign spokesperson Robbie Mook talking about the alleged source of the leak of those Democratic National Committee emails that have been so disruptive.
They believe that it was Russian state actors who took these emails. And what further experts are saying is that then, because they possessed those emails, that Russian state actors were feeding the emails to hackers for the purpose of helping Donald Trump.
20,000 internal DNC emails hacked by the Russians and then turned over to WikiLeaks before their release over this past weekend ahead of the Democratic convention. And, of course, the resignation of DNC chairman Debbie Wasserman Schultz as a result of that leak. That's the allegation. We added the chuckling, the vodka, and the blinis, but the FBI has already started an investigation. For Ann Applebaum, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post, who has watched Russian dirty tricks in elections for years, she says this is old hat.
The point is that the Russians now have a very long record in either hacking emails, making secret tapes, finding what they call compromat or compromising information about somebody and publishing it at a crucial moment in a political cycle in order to disrupt that cycle. They've done it before. They've done it in Ukraine. They've done it in Poland. They've done it in Slovakia. They or people who are close to them, I should say. But the method is always the same and the impact is always the same. And what's amazing to me about this time around is just same way it happens in Ukraine. People don't focus on why the hack happened or who wants it to happen or what the motivations of the Russian hackers are. They're focused on what's in the emails and what they say. And they immediately start arguments exactly as they were meant to do. So this is a very established Russian tactic that's been used multiple times in democratic elections, mostly in Europe.
And when you say the impact is the same every time, is that to say it's successful?
It's successful in that it makes people argue. It's designed to create aggravation. It's designed to take people's minds off the bigger issues. It's designed to make people focus on, in this case, it's designed to make people focus on the, you know, the DNC and Bernie and Hillary and make the party on the eve of its convention argue with itself. And I think it actually did succeed in doing that.
So you believe absolutely these emails come from some Russian source?
I believe it. I've seen several accounts written by credible people, you know, which describe how the hack was uncovered and the Russian markings on the malware that was used. So I assume that to be correct. But of course, the background is that I've seen it happen before. I live part of the time in Poland. I follow elections in European countries, and I've seen exactly this pattern of events happen. You know, when it happened, I was stunned. It was like from exactly out of the Russian security services playbook. So I couldn't put my hand on a Bible and swear this is what happened, but it certainly looks like that. And it follows a pattern. You know?
No, I understand completely. And that would mean that as Secretary of State, former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton would understand this playbook, and perhaps her rescue of Debbie Wasserman Schultz as giving her a job in the campaign is some sign that she believes that this was something that she's a victim of, as opposed to she's guilty of some bad tactics during the campaign.
Right. Well, I mean, for all I know, she's guilty of bad tactics, too. I have no idea. But that would indicate that, you know, it's interesting because one of the previous time that a U.S. official was very publicly caught by this was a Russian tape rather than a hack was Victoria Nuland, who was Deputy Secretary of State, who was caught on a tape talking to the American ambassador in Ukraine. This is during the Maidan Revolution in 2014. And nevertheless, Nuland kept her job and was considered to be, you know, promoted and so on. So that indicated to me the State Department knew this was a Russian plant. It was a piece of Russian disinformation tactics, and they let her stay. So, yes, there's a tradition of letting U.S. public officials who've been embarrassed by a Russian leak stay on. And, of course, the even more famous is the WikiLeaks, which, you know, affected quite a lot of U.S. diplomats.
Why would the Russians want Donald Trump to be president?
Donald Trump has very long business links to Russia. They know him. He has Russian funding for some of his companies. He's involved with Russian oligarchs who've bought his properties. The Russians like to have relationships with people who they have kind of dirty information on or inside information, so they would feel comfortable with him. More obviously, Trump himself speaks openly of Putin and of admiring Putin and of wanting to be like Putin. And there seems to be some, you know, there's an argument that says Putin is what Trump wants to be. He's actually a lot richer than Trump. He lives in much more elaborate palaces. He's much more powerful. So he may be a kind of role model for Trump, and the Russians can play with that. Trump is surrounded by people who are deeply involved in Russian and Ukrainian politics. His campaign manager, Paul Manafort, spent many, many years working in Ukraine for Viktor Yanukovych, who was the Russian candidate for president of Ukraine. And this was the one who was run out of Ukraine in 2014 after the revolution. And believe me, in Ukrainian politics, every dirty trick that you can imagine was used. Every piece of disinformation, troll armies, you know, hacks, fake information, also the use of thugs at rallies. I mean, there are a lot of elements of Ukrainian politics that I've seen emerging in the U.S. election campaign. You know, so and Manafort is running the campaign. He's very close to Trump. He's somebody the Russians know and like. So, you know, this is their candidate.
Well, finally, then, and if I could just break it into two parts, I mean, do you think this is just the beginning of these sorts of things? And is it possible that the Russians have leverage over Trump, given all of that
sort of Trump-ogarchical envy that you're describing.
It's very possible they have leverage over him. If it's true that there's Russian money keeping his company together, which is what some people claim, then they have real leverage over him. And it's also true that they have insiders who are right around him. The first part of your question, though, which is, you know, is this just the beginning? One of the other patterns of these kinds of Russian influence operations is that they tend to be, it's not usually just one hack, it's several. We could now see a stream of things coming out. I mean, I don't know from where, maybe not only the DNC, maybe from other places. We could see a stream of leaks and hacks and other things coming out between now and November if the Russians conform to patterns. So this may be just the beginning in that sense as well.
Anne Applebaum is a foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I could have danced all night, I could have danced all night, and still have begged for more.
Can you recognize that voice? There's something about a pure soprano voice. It becomes the emblem of femininity itself. It's as though it's not coming from the singer at all. And in the case of actresses Deborah Carr, Natalie Wood, and Audrey Hepburn, their singing voices in the movies came from someone else, the ghostly voice of an angel.
Why are it wants my heart to fight? I only know when he...
That's Marnie Nixon, who passed away at home this past weekend. She sang that voice for those actresses, a not terribly unusual situation in the early days of voice recording. Nixon entitled her memoir in 2006, I Could Have Sung All Night, My Story. She wrote it with a ghostwriter of her own, Stephen Cole. Cole's an award-winning theater writer. He joins us in the studio today. So you're the ghost of a ghost.
I am the ghost of a ghost. But, you know, in this case, Marnie made sure that I got credit in the book because she never got credit for the films.
And she fought that, I think, for much of her life, even though she was well known among people in the theater.
Oh, yeah. Marnie was a famous concert singer, yeah. Opera singer, theater singer. But in Hollywood, they said to her, if anybody ever finds out that you sang any of the songs in these movies, you'll never work in this town again. Which scared her. So during The King and I, she never told anybody, but Deborah Carr went out on a limb and told a columnist in New York that Marnie sang some of her high notes. And that started to break down the secrecy.
Did she like doing that or did she resent it?
It was a job at first. It was really, she made $400 a song for The King and I and no royalties for that best-selling soundtrack. But by the time she did West Side Story and sang for Natalie Wood, she fought a little more for, she didn't get credit, but she got a royalty because Leonard Bernstein gave her a piece of his royalty.
Uh-huh.
And she opened up a door for singers like herself and then, of course, got it for My Fair Lady also. But as far as being the secret singer, it got to a point after My Fair Lady when everybody knew about it that she thought, I could do these parts myself. Why am I doing this? And she stopped doing it.
Huh. So when she was doing West Side Story, what are the kinds of backroom sort of details? Because she was asked to do accents.
Yes. And of course, Natalie Wood wanted to do all her own singing. So they would actually go into a recording studio. Natalie Wood would sing the song with the orchestra. Everyone would say, oh, Natalie, you're so wonderful. You're so good. And then turn around and roll their eyes because she wasn't. Marnie would come in and sing the same song with the orchestra and the band would all applaud. And which made Natalie feel kind of rotten. But yeah, but Marnie, then after the film was over and Natalie sang to all her own tracks, she had to go in and post-dub every note with accents. And in fact, at one point, sings with herself in the film. If you listen to A Boy Like That and I Have a Love, Rita Moreno's dubber couldn't be there one day. She got sick, so Marnie sang with herself.
They both had colds when we were recording The Rumble. So Saul Chaplin, who was the musical director, said, well, Marnie, can you do Rita's voice? And so I said, sure. So I sort of colored my voice a little. And so then I ended up doing a duet with myself. Just a few measures there. Anita's going to get her kicks tonight. And then I'm going, tonight.
So that's from a Weekend Edition piece in 2006. It's so sad to think of her gone now, because really this is such a versatile voice that could do so many things and on a dime.
Incredibly so. When she worked with Audrey Hepburn, who was much more open to it than Natalie Wood, she told me that she had to make her mouth very, very tiny so that she could get that kind of sound out, because Audrey had a tiny little mouth. So she technically, she knew how to do everything, and she knew how to protect her own voice, but also just become those characters, because she was a really good actress.
Stephen Cole, ghostwriter for Marnie Nixon's autobiography, I Could Have Sung All Night, My Story. She is the ghost for so many actresses singing in famous recordings in movies.
Well, I have to tell you one more thing. We wanted to call the book Audrey Hepburn Dubbed My Face, but the publisher wouldn't let us.
That was smart.
Yeah.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
All right, here's something to take with you today. I'm going to take it with me. We'll return to the mystery raised by Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, Robbie Mook. Listen.
They believe that it was Russian state actors who took these emails.
Russian state actors? Does he mean the legendary Anatoly Papanov?
Не благородив, мы с мужиками порешили просто. Братва.
Or Евгений Леонов?
Рассказывай, как ты, где ты?
Ну, работаю на шарикоподшипнике, инженер.
Russian state actors playing characters in a Russian drama or comedy? Could it be that this fellow here...
The truth is that he is strong and he's tough and he's making our president look very bad.
I don't know. We're told to watch out for Russian state actors. I'm certainly watching. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. This is Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.